Okay, well, we're in the book of Genesis, the book of beginnings. And we are in chapter 7. This whole chapter deals with the greatest catastrophe, in the history of the world. It is a chapter that is completely devoted to the flood. God's judgment on a world that turned away from Him and became wicked. In this chapter, everything under the heavens that breathed was destroyed by drowning. As Peter tells us in 2 Peter 3:6, the world that existed at that time was destroyed by flood waters. The world that existed at that time was destroyed by flood waters. It perished. The wickedness of man reached to such a level, to such an extent, God stepped in and said enough. And you know, liberal theologians and people of this world, they hate this story. They hate it. It's a very unpopular story. And why is that? Because it's a story dealing with judgment. A judgment on a world that was wicked. People that behave in a wicked way, the last thing they want to hear about is God's judgment. So they make fun of it. And recently, Hollywood mocked Noah with their own little rendition of Noah's flood. And they paid some big movie star to play the part of Noah. And they made up their own story. And from what I have read, the Lord does not even speak to Noah in the movie. Not at all. The biblical account is much different. In every chapter dealing with Noah, Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9, God speaks to Noah. Noah hears the word of the Lord. In every chapter dealing with Noah, chapter 6, 7, 8, 9, God speaks to the man Noah. So what we read here in chapter 7 of Genesis, this is not a myth. This is not a fable of some kind. It doesn't even fit the pattern of a fable. Moses doesn't say once upon a time, a long time ago. We've heard fables before. The goose who laid the golden egg. These stories are obviously fables. But Peter, who wrote about Noah, who believed in Noah and the flood three different times in his two letters in the New Testament, 1 Peter chapter 3, 2 Peter chapter 2, and 2 Peter chapter 3, he wrote about the flood. He wrote about Noah. And he specifically said in 2 Peter 1:16, we did not follow cunning devised fables. We did not follow cunning devised fables. So what you're reading here this morning, what you're being preached about, or what's being preached about here, is not a fable. The biblical account of Noah and the flood is written as history. Moses tells us the exact date, the exact month, and the exact year the flood took place. Genesis 7:11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, a little specific there, on that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth and the windows of heavens were opened. And rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife, and the three wives of his sons, with them entered the ark. They and every beast according to its kind, and all the livestock according to their kinds, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and every bird according to its kind, every winged creature. They went into the ark with Noah, two and two of all flesh, in which there was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female, all of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. Last time we looked at verses 11 and 12, which tells us the exact date the flood begins. It also reveals to us the source of the flood waters, where the flood waters came from. Back in chapter 6, verse 13, the Lord spoke to Noah the first time. And he directly warned him. He told Noah that he was going to destroy the human race. He told Noah how to be saved from the impending destruction. He told him to build an ark. And building the ark was not Noah's idea. It wasn't Noah's plan. It was God's idea. It was God's way of salvation. Why? Because the Bible says very clearly in Psalm 3:8, salvation belongs to who? The Lord. In Psalm 37:39, the salvation of the righteous is from the Lord. Over and over again in the Psalms, he is the God of my what? Salvation. So when it comes to salvation, we cannot make up our own way of salvation. Pray this prayer. Say the Roman road. All you have to do is believe one time. See, Noah did not make up a way to be saved. The Lord told him how to be saved. And what did Noah do? He simply obeyed. He simply obeyed. Also, we saw that God didn't build the ark for Noah. He told Noah, you do it. It was up to Noah to pick up the hammer. And that shows human responsibility in salvation. Human responsibility in salvation. It would also be a process. So it's such a clear picture of our salvation. It would also be a process. Noah did not build the ark in a couple of days, or a couple of weeks, or a couple of months, or a couple of years. It was not a moment of time or instant salvation. It was a long process. He had to endure a long process. A process with many temptations to quit. And let me tell you, I am sure of it. Because in salvation, there are temptations to quit. Many hardships along the way. And we better believe that Noah had many temptations to turn away from God's command and follow the easier path with less resistance. And we can know this for sure because Noah is mentioned among those in Hebrews 11 who were righteous and were saved because they finished what? Faithfully. And two verses before that great chapter of salvation in Hebrews chapter 11, two verses before that, Hebrews 10, 38 and 39, it tells us what the whole chapter 11 is all about. It's a salvation chapter. Some like to call it the faith chapter, but it is a salvation chapter. Hebrews 10:38 says, "My righteous one will live by faith, and if he turns back, my God says, soul will take no pleasure in him." Now, we do not belong to those who turn back and are destroyed, but to those who have faith and are saved. So the whole chapter of chapter 11 begins right after those two verses. That whole chapter is about being saved or being destroyed. And that chapter is dealing with those who were saved and how to be saved. My point is that Noah did not turn back, although he was tempted to do such. Noah and all those in Hebrews 11 died in faith. And we have read that Noah was told by God to build the ark, stock it with food, and put all the animals in it. And he gave him precise directions. He gave him the building material to use. He told him that how it should be waterproofed. He told him how tall it would be, how long it would be, and how wide it would be. He told him to put 3 stories inside the ark. He told him to have compartments. He told him to have a window. He told him to have a door. It was this giant wooden box. It was not designed to go anywhere. It was designed just to float. It was not made to sail like a boat or a ship. It had no steering wheel. It had no brakes. It was designed for optimum stability. It was built to be stable. It was the perfect ratio for boat stability. The second time we see God speaking to Noah is 100 years later in chapter 7, verse 1. There was 100 years of silence. Keep that in mind. No word from God, and Noah just kept obeying. He kept building. He kept doing what God told him to do, trusting the Lord that he would take care of everything else. And that's what we do, right? That's the life of faith. We just keep on going. We keep on going. We keep on obeying. And we'll see people fall to the left, to the right. We keep going. We keep going. And trust God that he will deal and take care of everything as long as we continue on the straight and narrow path, the difficult way that leads to life. God did not appear to Noah every day as he was building the ark to make sure that he was doing everything he was told. I'm here, Noah, I'm here, keep building. No, he didn't do that. He did not keep reminding Noah. When we come to chapter 7, the ark is done. It is complete. Noah did all that God commanded. That is how chapter 6 ends. And he waited patiently to hear the voice of God, the voice of his Lord. Then finally God speaks a second time to Noah. And keep in mind, Noah did not just get on the ark. He did not presume, okay, now it's built, let's get in the ark. Let's make this our house. No. He waited. And God tells Noah in chapter 7, verse 1, to come into the ark. God tells Noah that there are 7 days left before the flood. 7 days. And after 7 days, judgment's going to fall. And he's now commanded to get in the ark with his family and with the animals. It would take 7 days for Noah and all the passengers to board the ark. Loading the ark is a 7-day process. The date of the flood is marked by Noah's 600th birthday. And I gave you a piece of paper this morning with the chronology of the flood. Very important to understand that chronology. The date of the flood is marked by Noah's 600th birthday. And that's what we just read this morning. It was on that very day that Noah entered the ark. That is approximately 1,650 years after original creation. 1,650 years after original creation. And we get that time period by looking at the genealogies in chapter 5 of Genesis. Remember, the 120 years given in Genesis 6:3, that is not how long it took Noah to build the ark. Some make that mistake. The scriptures are actually very silent on this, how long it took actually for Noah to construct the ark. But most commentators say between 55 to 75 years for Noah to construct the ark, depending upon the birth dates of Noah's sons. Noah is first mentioned in Genesis 5, verse 32, and he is 500 years old, and that is when he has his first son. And the flood came 100 years later in Genesis 7, 6. So allowing 25 to 30 years for his sons to grow up and get married, that leaves about 70 years to build the ark. So the 120 years that God gave in Genesis 6:3 is a countdown. It is a prophetic countdown to the flood. The Lord had seen enough of wickedness and violence, and after 120 years, judgment will fall on the world. Now, one thing to keep in mind about the flood here in chapter 7, as we mentioned last time, this is not an ordinary flood. God did not just allow this to happen or allow nature to take its course. He planned it. He planned it. He predicted it would happen 120 years in advance. He says why it would happen. And he did this because he wanted to make sure that no one would get the impression that this was just an accident of nature or just some natural disaster. So the ark took about 75 years to build, not 120 years. On the 600th year of Noah, the floodwaters came upon the earth. And it came from two sources, as we read in chapter 7, verse 11. The waters come from below. The earth's crust cracks open, and water springs or wells that were deep in the ground from original creation burst forth like geysers. That's the picture. I mean, this was a major movement of the earth's surface, a major shift in the ground. And then we have the second source. From above, the windows of heavens opened, meaning that the clouds in the sky poured forth heavy torrential rain, a rainfall like never before. The length of this rain was given to us by Moses, 40 days and 40 nights. Now, a lot of people think that Noah was on the ark only 40 days and 40 nights. But this is wrong, as we will see later. He was on the ark for a little more than a year. I want you to think about this. What is the greatest amount of rainfall ever recorded in one 24-hour day? I decide, well, I'm going to Google that and find out what actually is the record. 6 feet in 24 hours. 6 feet of water in 24 hours. This happened in 1966 on Reunion Island, located approximately 670 kilometers east of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean. The event occurred with the passage of Tropical Cyclone Denise in the South Indian Ocean. 6 feet of water in 24 hours. That's a lot of water. But we have to keep in mind when we read the flood record in the Bible, this is no ordinary rainstorm. Again, the Great Flood is not some ordinary natural disaster or flood. And that's why Moses tells us specifically in Genesis 7:11, water came from two sources, below and above the earth. This tells us that the flood is absolutely unique. The Hebrew and Greek words were that are used for Noah's flood are different. They're unique. They're only used for Noah's flood. There are other words that could be used for general floods, but there is a unique word in the Hebrew and in the Greek for the great flood in Noah's day. The writers don't want us to confuse Noah's flood with just some ordinary natural flood. In verse 13 of Genesis 7, it makes it very clear on that very same day that the water began to flow from below and above, Noah and his family and the animals entered the ark. And that is 7 days after the warning of Genesis 7:4. Then at the end of verse 16, we have this very powerful statement. That's where we had left off, at the end of verse 16. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. I mean, this is the great divide. This was the great separation. This was the point of no return. Time is up. The long suffering of God is over. God does not keep that door open forever. A lot of people don't like to hear that truth. But God does not keep the door open forever. The long suffering of God that desires every man to come to repentance rather than perish has a time where it ends. And the fact is, here in the record, not all repented, and therefore not all were saved. You have those who are now inside the ark, and you have those that are on the outside of the ark. There's the great division. Those inside would be saved, and those on the outside would perish. One commentator said this: what was the day like for the people of Noah's generation? He said, I'll tell you what it was like. It was like any new morning. No alarm, no thought of their doom. Jesus makes this point in portraying his own sudden coming. That generation will be like Noah's, eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage. They are carrying on with the normal affairs of their lives, indifferent to the gathering clouds above. The old world, the ancient world that Peter called it, is now brought to an end. The Lord is the one who shuts the door. There was no help of human hands. And that reveals to us that the Lord will be the one who protects the ark. He will be the one who watches over it. Noah did his part. He went in. He went inside as the Lord commanded. And the Lord seals him inside. Now the covenant-keeping God would do his part in keeping Noah and his family, the believing remnant, and all the animals safe and secure. You see, security is always conditional. Noah did all that was commanded of him by the Lord, and now the Lord will deliver him. The Lord will keep him. And this reminds me of Hebrews 5:9, where it says, he became the source of our eternal salvation to all who obey him. To all who obey him. Oh, he's the source of our eternal salvation. But it's to all who obey him. Let's continue in our story here in Genesis 7:17. The flood continued 40 days on the earth. Waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. What is the writer saying here? The water got higher and higher. The picture here is that the water rose very, very fast. It was a very rapid rate. And the ark began to rise off the ground. It was lifted up high above the earth's surface. And you could just imagine the people outside the ark. They probably did their very best to survive. They probably built some rafts or some kind of makeshift boat. They probably went to higher ground to try to escape the rising water. But it was to no avail. It was all in vain. They could not escape. Peter says God didn't spare them. You know what that word spare means? Spare means to show leniency. To spare someone means you show a mercy. God did not spare the ancient world. He didn't spare them. They could go to the highest mountain, but that highest mountain could not save them. They were on the outside, not on the inside. And we will see in the next verse, the waters prevailed over the earth and over the mountains. Verse 18, the waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the waters four times. Verses 18, 19, 20, and 24, Moses writes, the waters prevailed. And this Hebrew word prevail is a military word for succeeding and overcoming in battle. It has to do with victory. Victory over an adversary. Victory over an opponent. It means to conquer an opponent. This is the same word Moses used of himself in Exodus 17:11. Whenever Moses held up his hands, Israel prevailed. Whenever he lowered his hands, Amalek prevailed. The waters were prevailing over the earth's surface. They became dominant over the land. The earth and everything on it, the trees, the buildings, the structures, they were no match for the water. And we've seen the awesome power of water, the amazing force. We've seen videos of how it just sweeps things away. Snaps trees just in half. Cars are picked up and just tossed. Whole cities, I said, you can see it on YouTube. Whole cities just wiped out in a matter of seconds. And all that is occurring all over the earth. This mass of water is dominating the earth. Everything on the surface was being conquered. Everything on the surface was being defeated. That is the picture of the waters prevailing. And not only was the ark lifted off the ground, it began to float on the face of the waters. It didn't have a sail. It was driven along by whatever forces of wind were there at that time. And it began to float. And in fact, it went from the Middle East, somewhere in the Middle East, and it floated all the way up to the border of Turkey and Armenia, where Mount Ararat is. Verse 19, and the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. And the waters rose more than 20 feet above the mountains. Genesis 7, 19 and 20, these two verses here emphasize something very important to us. It emphasizes a worldwide, global flood. Notice what it says in verse 19. All the high mountains that were under the whole heaven were covered. In the Hebrew language, this is a double superlative. A double superlative. All the whole. And what is the point of this? The point is this. Nothing was left uncovered. That is what the double superlative communicates. You cannot mistake this kind of clear language for some kind of local flood. This is clear, universal language, all and under the whole heaven, reveals a worldwide global flood. And not only that, in verse 20, the water rose more than 20 feet above all the mountains. Now you get the point? I mean, you can't take these words at face value and say the flood was local in nature. I mean, it makes utter nonsense for Noah to spend 75 years of his life building this big ark longer than a football field to simply survive a local flood. If it was just a localized flood, the Lord could have easily taken Noah to another location on the earth, just as he took Lot later in Genesis from Sodom and moved him to somewhere else. Genesis 7 is not describing something local. You would have to completely ignore the simple meaning of words. If the flood was local, why take two of every animal? There would be other animals left that would reproduce. What about the birds? The birds, they could. Why were they brought aboard the ark if it's local? They could just fly to some higher mountain peak. Another question we could ask, how would a localized flood terminate the corruption of the human race and the wickedness of man? Also, if the flood was localized and not world and global, why did Jesus refer to the days of Noah as how it will be when he returns a second time? The second coming of Jesus Christ will be the end of the world. And it's not local in nature. It is worldwide. Once the flood is over, we see that it takes months and months for the waters to recede and dry up. Almost a greater part of a year. And we've seen that these local floods, we've been in Lodgeput Nugger when the cars are floating down the road and they dry up very quickly. Think about it. More than 20 feet above the highest mountain peak. I mean, even if only half the ark cleared the water, it would still clear the highest mountain. They say that there's enough water in the oceans right now to cover the earth 8,000 feet deep if the surface of the earth were smooth. Now, I agree with many people on this who say that the pre-flood earth surface was very different than what we witness today. The mountains, I believe, in the pre-flood world were not as high as they are today. And it would make sense to me that the surface of the earth would be dramatically changed as a result of something so powerful as a worldwide flood. And what would really be affected by such a global catastrophe? Erosion. Erosion would be unbelievable. Now, I've just witnessed erosion at where I work, at my shop. The waters from this recent monsoon has exposed the pipe that leads to my pump box. It was completely covered with dirt, and the erosion has moved the waters from the monsoon. Now it's exposed. I have to cover that back up again. That's what erosion does, and that's just simply a local monsoon. But I do believe the surface of the earth was dramatically changed. I don't think the high mountain peaks that we have today were there before the flood. Neither were these deep valleys and canyons such as the Grand Canyon. These things came about through the powers of the great flood. What we see on the earth's surface today, such as the great fault lines, the deep canyons, and the high peaks such as Mount Everest, are a result of the flood. And you say, what verse do you have for that? There's a psalm that we need to look at this morning. Turn to Psalm 104. Psalm 104. Now, I know that some consider this a creation psalm, but verses 5 through 9 seem to be, to me, to describe the flood. And I think many people see it this way. Psalm 104, verses 5 to 9. I'm reading through from the English Standard Version. He set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep. That is water. With the deep. As with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. Notice that. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. Then verse 8. Notice what verse 8. Verse 8. The mountains rose and the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth. He's talking about water there. And that fits very well with the covenant that God makes with Noah in chapter 9. Answers in Genesis says this about this verse, verse 8. Verse 8 is referring to tectonic movements in the earth's crust during the recessional stage of Noah's flood, and not to any events on day 3 of creation week. Henry Morris, Christian scientist, says this: the first 5 verses of the psalm apply to creation period, but it's obvious that verses 6 through 9 apply to the flood, with an allusion to God's covenant with Noah in verse 9. I think he's right. So the flood waters covered a pre-flood earth whose surface was less pronounced than it is today. Because that's what people say. Well, there's not enough water to cover 32,000 feet or however high the highest mountain is. Well, it would if the mountains were smaller and the surface had less valleys and less peaks. A less pronounced surface. One writer said, if the mountains rise up higher and the valleys drop down further, as spoken of here in the psalm, that would create a greater distance between the highest and lowest points on the earth and result in an earth which cannot be completely covered with water. According to this psalm, God in this way set a boundary that the waters would not be able to pass over so that they would not return to cover the earth. Most of the rock layers in the walls of the Grand Canyon, and that's more than a mile above sea level, contain marine fossils. Fossilized shellfish are even found in the mountains of the Himalayas. The top 3,000 feet of Mount Everest, 26,000 to 29,000 feet, is made up of sedimentary rock packed with seashells and other ocean-dwelling animals. What does the fossil record prove? Well, the evolutionists want us to say there was this constant struggle of life and death over billions of years. That's not what the fossil record reveals. The fossil record proves the flood. It is a testimony of the greatest catastrophe that the earth has ever experienced, the great flood in the Bible. You know, fossils don't form overnight. Now, I'm not here to tell you that I'm a geologist or a scientist and I'm going to wow you with my expertise here. But fossils don't form overnight. The fossil record was formed through a special and unique event. A very rapid burial of water with a high, extreme, pressurized situation. And that's what we find in the fossil record. Billions, billions of dead plants and animals buried and fossilized in sand and mud and lime. deposited rapidly by water in rock layers. The fossil fuels, we've heard a lot about the fossil fuels, coal and oil. What are they? They're fossilized plants that were buried rapidly under great pressure. That's all it is. If I were to take an apple today and stand on my balcony and finish that apple, throw it out into the jungle, that apple core is not going to fossilize. Right? It's not going to fossilize. Most likely that crow who is watching me eat the apple is going to come down and take it and have lunch. If the crow didn't see me, the ants would get it. And if the ants don't get it, bacteria will get it. That thing is going to be gone in a few days. Okay? When a fish dies in the ocean, what happens to the fish? It turns into a fossil in the rock. No, it does not. Most of the time, the fish floats on the surface of the water and is eaten by other fishies. Or if it comes upon the land and a dog eats it, or bacteria eats it, it decays. Returns to the dust. The fossil record is something that shows us whole animals, something unique. Whole animals preserved beautifully. Beautifully with details. With no time for the process of decay. Did you hear me? No process of decay. Beautiful preservation of whole Siberian mammoths. Frozen in ice. Frozen with grass still in their mouth. Frozen in the ice. Something extraordinarily happened in order to form the fossil record that we have today. And that's exactly what we have in the flood account, a unique event. Fossilized fish that were buried so rapid, virtually alive, that even the details of their fins and the eye sockets have been preserved. On every continent, we find fossils of sea creatures in rock layers that today are high above sea level. Petrified clams that are closed, they're in a closed position all over the world, testify to their rapid burial while they were still alive, even at the top of Mount Everest. So how did these marine limestone sedimentary rock beds get to high places like the Himalayas? Only one possible explanation. The ocean waters at some time in the past flooded the continents. More than 7 trillion tons of vegetation is buried in the world's coal beds across every continent, including Antarctica. Sedimentary rock is found all over the world. What is sedimentary rock? It's formed through pressure and water. The fossil record is best explained not by evolution, but by a worldwide flood. Verses 21 to 23 describes the results of the devastation of the flood. A description of complete and total utter universal destruction. Verse 21 of Genesis 7. This is the result. And all flesh died that moved on the earth. Birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth and every man. All in whose nostrils was the breath of life, the breath of the Spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. All. So he destroyed all. Are we seeing something over and over again here? All. He destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle and creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Here's what he says. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. Verses 21 and 23 is the promised fulfillment of what God warned Noah of, right? He told him he was going to do this, and that this is the fulfillment of it right here. God obliterated every living thing which was on the face of the ground. What does that tell us? He keeps his word. God is true. He keeps his word. Destruction came 120 years just like God said it would. Again, all and every makes no sense unless it's a worldwide global destruction of all living things. And I like that phrase in verse 23. The English Standard Version has it this way. Only Noah was left. Only Noah was left and those who were with him in the ark. Only Noah was left. What does that point to? It points to a righteous remnant of the former world. The Lord always has a remnant. A remnant is a small group out of a larger population. Genesis 7:24 concludes the chapter with the duration of the flood. The waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. The earth was totally covered by water for 150 days. Ladies and gentlemen, that's 5 months. I think God wanted to make sure everything was dead. 5 months. In order for flood chronology to make sense, the 150 days must cover the 5 months from the coming of the flood in Genesis 7:11 to the grounding of the ark in Genesis 8:4. And in closing, this is what Peter has testified and what I have already quoted in 2 Peter 3:6. The world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. Peter in 2 Peter 2:5 calls it the old ancient world. It was not spared. God did not exercise leniency. He did not show mercy. He did not refrain himself from inflicting punishment or destruction. God did not spare the ancient world.